Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
The main reason that we decided to file the lawsuit at this time is that when you read the antitrust decision in the NCAA case, it's almost like an invitation for somebody to challenge the existence of the exemption, particularly in the way it came up in the context of that case. But in addition to that, most of the prior challenges have come up in very specific situations that are, you know, somewhat limited in terms of their scope. Here, you had an agreement among these 30 teams where it impacted little towns all over America. And David says it in some ways better than I, but the reality is in many of these little towns all over America, the minor league teams that were eliminated is the only game in town. So it had a much broader impact than the prior cases that were more focused on things like scouting and the like.
Don't worry, I'm not going to sing for you today, but if I were to sing for you, it would be the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Minor Thing, which goes, "It's just a minor thing, and I'm a minor king." Ain't that the truth? Welcome back to the Athletic Baseball Show. I'm senior writer for The Athletic, Evan Drellick. We're moving to a different segment of the labor world today. You might have just guessed it. Thematic continuity, minor league baseball, and the myriad issues connected to it. First, though, real quick, I know why you're here. Little lockout update. MLB and the MLBPA did indeed meet last week. They also have a meeting scheduled for this week. But like last week's meeting, this week's is on non-core topics. Doesn't mean they are subjects that they don't eventually have to get done. Doesn't mean they're entirely unimportant. It just means that this is not the main course, the entree, the steak and potatoes. Forgive me to the vegan listeners. We've got two interviews today. First up is Harry Marino, who's the executive director of the nonprofit Advocates for Minor Leaguers. If you haven't been following, minor league players seem to have had an awakening in the last year, maybe 2 years, pushing for change in their living and working conditions, and they had a big victory this year. MLB has agreed to provide housing for most minor league players, but as Harry will explain, that's just the start of their plans. And then stick around after Harry. We've got a conversation with two of the lawyers who just brought a lawsuit on Monday challenging the sport's antitrust exemption for MLB's actions in the minor leagues and their contraction of 40 teams. They cut down from 160 teams to 120. Here's Harry. You are the executive director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers. Can you give people a brief overview of what that organization does?
Yeah, sure. So Advocates for Minor Leaguers is a nonprofit labor advocacy group that exists to fight for better wages and working conditions for minor league players. We formed in 2020, and since then we've been working to provide players with the collective voice that they've lacked for decades.
How did you end up at Advocates? What was your path to the organization?
You know, I'm a former minor league baseball player myself. I experienced the difficulties of the minor league life firsthand as a member of the Diamondbacks and Orioles organizations back in 2012 through 2014. So, you know, it started there, my awareness of these issues. I mean, I remember my first year with the Diamondbacks, I think I made $3,300 for the entire year. You know, when I was with the Orioles, I remember seeing, you know, five guys sleeping in a one bedroom apartment. So, you know, these experiences were formative for me. Obviously, my eyes were opened to the realities of the minor leagues as a player. You know, then I went to law school after my career as a player ended. And during my time in law school, I learned about what enabled this exploitation, which is baseball's unique antitrust exemption. basically, which gives teams, you know, legal permission to sit around a table and agree to pay their minor leaguers artificially low salaries and not to really compete with respect to the treatment of minor leaguers. No other sport has that, and no one from a legal perspective really defends it. And so I think it was kind of the two pieces, right, that I had lived it and seen the practical consequences of this really mistaken legal case that made me just fascinated with this issue and really want to step in and do anything I could to make a change. So when Advocates launched in 2020 and I read the articles, I didn't hesitate to reach out to the founders of the organization, and that's what kind of led me here.
In the second part of this podcast, we're going to talk more about the antitrust exemption as it relates to minor league baseball ownership. But when it comes to minor league player pay, how does the antitrust exemption interact with minor league players? Is it your belief that if the antitrust exemption didn't exist, that likely there would be legal challenges and there would be changes that come about?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, we certainly see the antitrust exemption as in many ways the fundamental basis for the mistreatment of the players, the minor league players themselves, because as I said, it's what deprives players of the same open market for their services that the rest of us get, right? So if I'm working at a law firm and another law firm is going to pay me more money, I can leave and go to that other law firm. And, you know, that fundamental freedom to contract and go to a place that's going to offer you better working conditions is sort of the bedrock of a competitive labor market and competitive free market economy. Basically, in any industry, except this one, workers have that ability. They can go out and get a better deal somewhere else if someone else values them more. Minor league baseball players don't have that, and instead, they're all forced to sign the same 7-year contract, making less than, you know, $15,000 a year. And that's obviously, you know, I think it goes without saying, far less than players are worth on an open market. I mean, one clear indication of that is when, you know, some players do actually make it to the end of the 7-year contract but haven't yet made it to the major leagues or been put on the 40-man roster, they can sign as a minor league free agent. And those minor league free agent deals are for quite, you know, a significantly higher salary than the standard minor league salary, right? You have players on a minor league free agent deal making, instead of $15,000 a year, $15,000 a month. Right. So it's very clear that that the antitrust exemption is what's artificially depressing minor league salaries and allowing teams to exploit minor leaguers. So, yeah, when we saw the lawsuit yesterday, you know, filed by the recently contracted teams, that marks a significant threat to the exemption. That's certainly something that we like to see.
Advocates is still a young organization, right? It's relatively new. Where would you say you are in your work? There was a big victory, at least what I think would be considered a big victory, in the housing issue this year. Where are you in the progression and how do you look at that housing victory?
Yeah, so I think the housing victory was huge and unprecedented. You know, basically when we, as you noted, we are a young organization. I remember talking to you back in whenever it was March or April, right when I started in this job as the first employee of Advocates. And so, yeah, we're really just months into our work, you know, in a sense. But when we started in April, we started reaching out to players and saying, look, we know there are a lot of issues at the minor league level, right? There's tons of directions we can go in here, but we want to see if we can bring players together around a single issue, if we can really push for some change, because we bet that we can. And what players said was housing is the first issue that we should focus on because, you know, for a long time, players have really struggled with the housing situation in the minor leagues. So what we did was essentially just get players to come together and start talking about their conditions more openly. And, you know, this year we saw tweets and articles in all kinds of outlets about the issue. You know, we had players sleeping in their cars, players sleeping in the team's clubhouse, players sleeping 7 or 8 guys to an apartment, everyone on air mattresses, players spending more than their entire paycheck on housing. And what we saw was fans actually cared. And there was a growing awareness around the minor league housing crisis, you know, as what some people dubbed it. And what's kind of, you know, funny in a sense, in a perverse way funny, is that the crisis wasn't new, right? What was new was the players speaking up about it. And so, you know, on September 18th, when we hosted a fan appreciation day and at about 10 stadiums across the country and handed out information about this stuff to fans, we found that fans were really appalled and surprised by the facts on the ground. And, you know, Mets and Phillies minor leaguers donned our teal fair ball wristbands during the game. And just 3 days later, the major league owners unanimously voted to provide furnished housing to players beginning in the 2022 season. So yeah, we see it as a really a tremendous victory for collective action and unprecedented in terms of, you know, minor league players actually making something change themselves.
Do you think the teams in the league decided to do that because they are scared? Is it a means of trying to concede a battle to win a war, in essence?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's an attempt to appease and quell the unrest that they're seeing. I think that they're very aware of what they're getting away with at the minor league level and what players are actually worth to them and how, you know, the margin between what the players are worth to the teams and what, you know, the players are actually being compensated at right now is so significant that I think that they're quite willing to make certain improvements, you know, to the treatment of minor leaguers in order to keep that fundamental dynamic the same, right? Where they're able to ultimately exploit the players and pay them far less than they're actually worth. And so I do think that it was a tactic by the league. And, you know, what I can say is players are smart to that, right? Players understand what's going on. The policy isn't perfect. I know that, you know, we've been talking to a lot of players are still in the process of getting a lot of feedback on the details of the policy and can, you know, certainly intend to advocate for changes to certain aspects of the policy that might be problematic and are problematic. At the same time, we know now that as players, when we come together, we can actually force some change. And so that sets a blueprint, right, for how to enact change on other issues as well.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Why don't we have a minor league union right now? What are the set of factors that have brought us to a point where, you know, you have a longstanding Major League Baseball Players Association, but we don't have one in the minors?
Yeah, so look, I think major league teams have utilized their antitrust exemption to cultivate a culture of fear in the minor leagues for a long time, right? And so what I mean by that is this: players know they're stuck with this one team for 7 years and they can't go to another team and get a better deal. So what does that mean? You know, pleasing and impressing the management and the front office of this team is your only path to the big leagues in this artificially restricted market that they've set up. And because of that, players for years have had no choice but to sort of go out of their way to please their teams. Because if you're this, you know, if you're the squeaky, squeaky wheel, so to speak, or you're, you know, you're the one who's seems like you're unhappy, well, there's 179 other guys who are trying to go down the same path who aren't. So that's kind of the culture that we've seen for a long time. Now, of course, the way to overcome that is to all speak collectively at the same time, right, as minor leaguers. And then the teams don't have any option but to listen because, you know, they're not just going to be able to turn to the guy next to you and say, well, he's staying quiet. And so that's really, you know, the core dynamic here is this antitrust exemption creates this really restricted path where players have to try to please their team to try to make it to the major leagues. I think what we've seen this year with housing, and you can, you know, certainly look at sort of how many public-facing statements were made by players this year, is that culture is starting to change, right? So players are starting to realize, okay, you know what? We're getting not just a little bit less than we're owed, we're getting a lot less than we're owed. And the teams are going to be willing to make improvements here because they're still going to be getting away with murder, right? And so players are like, you know what? We can speak up if we speak together. We now have a vehicle to do it through advocates, right? To actually coordinate that kind of collective action. And we're going to see concrete changes. So I think over time, what we're doing, you know, these are the steps that if we can continue to change the culture would lead to, you know, something like a minor league union being a real realistic possibility. But as you said, we're just, you know, we're just getting started here, and it's a long history of the culture being a certain way that we have to overcome.
This is a question would probably be best directed to the MLBPA, but do you have an understanding of why the MLBPA has not folded in minor leaguers, why that's not something that's happened at this point?
Yeah, look, as you said, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of the PA. What I can say is, you know, as I'm a lawyer, as we said, right? So I always think of these things sort of through that prism. And it's, you know, the folks who are in charge of the PA have a very specific duty, legal duty and charge, which is to represent their members, the members of the 40-man roster, right? And so at any one time, for the MLBPA to think about, you know, representing minor leaguers is just not, it's not what they're permitted to do, right? And I think this is, fans probably don't necessarily understand that, you know, for good reason. Why would they, right, be steeped in those kind of legal details? But the reality is, not only, you know, is it sort of like, oh, they don't really want to do it, they really can't do it. So, you know, really for minor leaguers to have their own union and to take that step has to come from minor league players. I mean, candidly, it can't come from advocates. It can't come from anyone. At the end of the day, minor league players have the right under the National Labor Relations Act to unionize, but it has to come from the minor league players themselves. It's not going to come from the MLBPA or from an outside entity stepping in on their behalf, if that makes sense.
Right. And if minor league players did want to unionize, then the MLBPA would have a choice, I think, right? They could theoretically decide to expand membership, but that's a complicated topic.
Yeah, exactly. Sure, certainly, if the facts on the ground were such that there was an appetite from minor league players, where minor league players were in a position to want union representation, then they would have, the minor league players would have all kinds of avenues available to them about how to do so. And joining an existing union like the MLBPA, that's certainly, you know, a mechanism that's available at that point.
So what happens from here? Where do you go next? What does 2022 hold? There was, I'm going to probably butcher this, but there was an announcement of something of a steering committee recently, right? What are the next steps we're going to see from you guys?
Yeah, so I think the steering committee announcement is a big step in this progression, right? We have now a lot of players who have come together to work together through our organization on improving minor league working conditions. And you know, dozens of those players are part of this newly formed steering committee that we have, who are going to help set sort of the direction of the organization and what our priorities are. And so, you know, the first thing that the steering committee did was put out a statement of support for the MLBPA and their current, you know, labor battle with MLB. And I would expect more statements from the steering committee going forward on issues related to minor league working conditions that we're working on. So yeah, I think bringing players together, just continuing that same the same type of work that we started this year on housing, in terms of bringing players together around an issue and showing the benefits and the power of collective action. And I think, you know, those issues are, you know, they abound, unfortunately, but I think off-season and year-round pay is probably the main thing that you're going to see us talking about next, because right now we have players who are working second and third jobs to support themselves during the off-season. They, you know, minor league players make $400 to $700 a week, but only during the season, right? They don't receive any paychecks in the off-season. They don't receive any paychecks in spring training. And so players, you know, minor league players received their last paycheck in September, and they won't receive another paycheck until April. So that's, I mean, and all during that time, they're under an obligation, a contractual obligation to their major league team to train, right? Obviously, I think as a practical matter, anyone would understand you want to be a pro baseball player. You got to work out and throw and hit year round. But it's not just practical. It's legal as well. There actually is an element of the uniform player contract that says players are required to perform contractual services on a year-round basis, even though they will only receive a salary payment during the championship season, right? So that's fundamentally unfair. Players can't make ends meet. They're trying to progress their game to the next level to, you know, put in many, many hours, you know, on a daily and weekly basis over the course of the offseason to prepare for next season as required by contract, not receiving any compensation for doing so and having to try to fit in, you know, trying to fit in other jobs just to pay rent, keep a roof over their heads, keep themselves fed and, you know, have their gym memberships and pay their trainers and all of that. I mean, so this is a difficult time for minor league players this offseason. And, you know, I think that's something that we will be working on, you know, especially as we move into the new year.
Your colleague at Advocates, Garrett Brocious, is an attorney as well at Corintillery, if I'm saying that right. And that firm has been involved in a proceeding that I think is about to enter its eighth year, a class action now lawsuit over minor league player pay, if I'm assessing that properly. Can you give any update on where that case is and what it could mean and when we might see some sort of update or resolution?
Yeah. So, I mean, Garrett is one of the co-founders of Advocates for minor leaguers. He's taken a step back now to focus on the case. So, you know, I think it's, for those who don't know, you know, the minor league wage lawsuit launched by Garrett and his firm at Corintillery is separate from, you know, the work at Advocates for minor leaguers. Now, obviously, we're all working towards the same overall goal of improving the situation for minor league players. So I can't speak too much to the details of the class action because it's just not, you know, what our organization is doing or what I'm working on. But what I can say is I believe it's headed for trial in June. So after this long haul and all the twists and turns the case has taken, we probably will get some resolution here in the next year. And I think there's a lot of reasons to believe that Major League Baseball should really be sitting around, you know, with everything that's been going on with Advocates, with the class action coming to a head, you know, that Major League Baseball really should be rethinking the way that it has traditionally treated minor league players. I think, you know, for a long time they've kind of gotten away with this and people haven't questioned it or people haven't pushed it, you know, past a certain point. And so they've just kept doing it. And I think we're now sort of reaching a new stage of these proceedings, so to speak, where players are way more active on these issues. The fans are more aware than ever before about the issues. You know, they're, as you said, moving to a stage where, you know, a jury is going to weigh in or, you know, and judge and say, you know, if they violated federal law. This is serious stuff for MLB. And I think it's time for them to really think about whether it's worth it, right? To exploit these guys, or whether maybe it's time to finally start just giving them what they're due.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Because we know they can afford it.
Maybe end on something of an existential note. Do you ever get people or yourself kind of approach the question of, Well, why should people care about minor leaguers as opposed to, I don't know, workers at Walmart or kind of the other set of plights that you could find in this country? Why should people care about baseball players any more or equivalent to other sets of people?
Yeah, look, I would say that people should care about both, right? I mean, to me, there's the work that we're doing at Advocates takes nothing away from how important it is to advocate for proper and appropriate and fair working conditions for all workers. And I think, you know, further to that, I would just say that baseball occupies a very important, privileged place in American society, right? This is the national pastime. It's been central to our culture for, you know, 150 years. And if you go back and look at, you know, at American history and baseball history, there's quite a lot of overlap in terms of things that go on in baseball tracking and shaping things that are happening in society at large. And so to me, you know, what we're seeing in the greater society right now is a lot of labor unrest, right? A lot of, especially after COVID has hit us and sort of and readjusted the way that a lot of industries work. The average working person understands that employers are benefiting tremendously off their labor and now have had the moment to sort of take a pause and say, what's this worth to me? Why am I doing this, right? Like, is there a better path for me? And as a result, we're seeing great energy in the labor movement where workers are asking for nothing crazy, just fair treatment, just saying, hey, I woke up to this. I was being treated really poorly. I really was providing a lot of value to you and I wasn't being compensated accordingly. And if I come together with my coworkers, I can just recoup what I'm actually entitled to. And I think what we're seeing right now at the minor league level, it's impossible to separate that out from that larger conversation. So I would say, you know, care about the worker at Walmart, care about the minor league baseball player, because at the end of the day, the American system of fairness and justice and a free market economy, these are things that are central, right? And that we should all care about. And I think it's playing itself out in minor league stadiums, just like it's playing itself out, you know, across the economy more largely.
Harry, thanks a lot.
Yeah, Evan, thanks. Appreciate you having me.
So as Harry Marino just alluded to a little bit there, you have to have a little understanding of the antitrust exemption to understand what's going on in minor league baseball and the business side of minor league baseball. Back in the 1920s, the Supreme Court gave baseball unique standing among American businesses. You might know this already. Said that MLB is exempt from the Sherman Antitrust Act. Basically, it gave MLB free rein to put into place anti-competitive practices that would never fly in other industries. On Monday, four minor league teams filed a lawsuit challenging that exemption. They're doing this after MLB in 2020, going into this year, totally reorganized and restructured minor league baseball. There used to be 160 minor league affiliates. There's now only 120, so 40 teams were effectively pushed out of the traditional umbrella. Without getting too technical here, the antitrust exemption is something that more directly affects other stakeholders in the sport besides major league players. It's more of an issue for minor league players and minor league owners. We're joined now by David Lender of the firm Weil, Gotshal & Manges and Jim Quinn of Berg & Andrefy. They represent the plaintiffs in this lawsuit that was just filed on Monday. Quinn used to be at the same firm as Lender, Weil, Gotshal. And it's the firm that also produced the MLBPA's Bruce Meyer, their lead negotiator. So we'll get a little insight from them, not only on the case, but on their former colleague Meyer as well. And Quinn is a star in the sports legal world. He's been involved in many lawsuits suing sports leagues over the years. I think it's probably a good place to start with explaining to people why the contraction in the minor leagues is an antitrust issue. I did a story several months ago trying to explain to myself as well as readers, well, what would change if the antitrust exemption doesn't exist? I think most people understand that this thing is there and it's been there for a long time, but don't necessarily grasp the practical application of it and what it does. So why is it that when Major League Baseball decides it wants to eliminate 40 teams and implement this new system, that antitrust matters to that decision?
No, that's a fair question. Well, you have to step back and think about it this way. The owners, the 30 owners, are competitors with each other on a lot of different levels. Players, coaches, IP. And one of the things they have been competitive over time about is their affiliations with minor league baseball. And what has happened is over the course of X number of years, the number of minor league teams increased in part as a result of this competition and the desire of individual teams to have additional affiliates. What occurred as a practical matter from an antitrust standpoint is you had a group of competitors who got together and basically said, listen, we don't really want to continue to have this competition about how many affiliates we should have because one team wants six and other teams want three. We want everything to be the same. So let's all agree as to the current 160, we are going to agree that we're going to eliminate 40 of them. And that'll save everybody money and we'll all be happy. We'll put ourselves on the same wavelength. We'll all agree we're only going to have four teams. I think it's four. I forget. They basically agreed to the same number. Yep. And that would be known in the real world as essentially illegal output restriction, because clearly the marketplace was such that more teams could and did exist. So they all agreed to save a bit of money that they were going to cut back on the number of teams. It's both a boycott on one hand, and on the other hand, it's an illegal output restriction.
There have been a lot of challenges, I guess, in different ways to the antitrust exemption over time. What is different about your challenge? I know there's some sense that what happened in the landmark NCAA case might have an impact. Can you explain why this should be regarded differently?
Sure. Look, I mean, obviously, the main reason that we decided to file the lawsuit at this time is that when you read the antitrust decision in the NCAA case, it's almost like an invitation for somebody to challenge the existence of the exemption, particularly in the way it came up in the context of that case. But in addition to that, most of the prior challenges have come up in very specific situations that are, you know, somewhat limited in terms of their scope. Here, you had an agreement among these 30 teams where it impacted little towns all over America. And David says it in some ways better than I, but the reality is in many of these little towns all over America, the minor league teams that were eliminated is the only game in town. So it had a much broader impact than the prior cases that we're more focused on things like scouting and the like.
If you think about it, Evan, the decision that originally recognized the antitrust exemption, it's really an anomalous decision. I mean, the idea that maybe back in 1922 when we were in horse and buggies, but that baseball doesn't actually impact interstate commerce, it was the essence of the decision. It really doesn't hold up, particularly where the Supreme Court has gone on interstate commerce. And as Jim said in the NCAA decision from last year, I mean, I have the quotes here. They called the federal baseball reasoning unrealistic, inconsistent, aberrational. We agree. I mean, it's literally the only sports league that has this anomalous, anachronistic thing, and it really shouldn't happen. And they would not have done what they did if they didn't believe they had some protection around this exemption. They just wouldn't do it.
And part of what they were arguing in the NCAA case, if I'm saying this right, is that they were deserving of some sort of analogous antitrust exemption. Yes. Why did this come up in the NCAA case?
That's exactly why it came up. It came up because essentially the NCAA was arguing based on their argument that they were promoting amateurism, and that amateurism, based on another case in the Board of Regents case where there was dicta to that effect, that amateurism should essentially allow for an exemption. And what the court was saying is we don't grant exemptions. Exemptions could only be granted by Congress. And it was in that context they talked about baseball and how aberrational it was. And that was the invitation that we decided to accept the invitation.
Is there any way to explain to people how much time this will likely take to arrive at its conclusion? Is it right to say that this case is designed to get in front of the Supreme Court as quickly as possible?
Yes. You've just took the words out of my mouth. And it's hard to know exactly how long that will take. But, you know, it's going to be at least a year, perhaps somewhat more.
If you lose the case, is there an opportunity here for incremental gain? Is there something beneficial about even bringing the case forward at all? Or is it black and white that if the antitrust exemption still stands at the end of this, you'll have lost and that's that?
Yeah, we are representing two of the four teams that brought the antitrust case, bringing certain state law claims against Major League Baseball, tort interference, breach of contract, those types of claims, that if the Supreme Court decided not to take this case, despite some of the things they've said before, we would still proceed and try to get remedies for those teams under state law claims. These are federal claims. They belong in federal court. So there may still be some relief, some recovery for some of the teams under state law. This is really, Jim and I felt working together on this, that this was the case. This was the right case to try to attack the antitrust exemption because, as Jim said, a lot of times the antitrust exemption was really about player movement and whatnot. But it is really hard to justify these teams in Schenectady, in Norwich, that are really were the epicenter of these communities, bringing tons and tons of tax revenues and jobs to these communities, and all of a sudden they're gone. It's really hard to explain to those local communities why they can't root for their teams anymore. And again, it'd be one thing if these were like unsuccessful teams or there was some legitimate reason for getting rid of them. These were four of the most successful minor league teams out there. Credible fan bases. It's just hard to justify. And that's why Jim and I got together and said, we have to do something.
If the antitrust exemption is so illogical, how do you explain to people why it still exists? I understand it to be a matter of precedent, but your words will be better than mine if you can explain why this thing still stands.
You know, there is no good reason why, other than inertia and the fact that it went before the Supreme Court on several occasions, the last time being the flood case in the early 70s. And since that time, there were a number of times where the issue was presented in cert petitions, as I said before, limited, kind of targeted way, and the Supreme Court decided not to take those cases. But here, after having said what they said, and given the fact, as I said on other occasions, you do have a new and different Supreme Court. And some of the most recent appointees are folks that are very focused on legal issues. They're brilliant jurists. And, you know, frankly, if they're thinking about overturning Roe v. Wade, I mean, if there's a better candidate for being overturned, I would say it's the baseball exemption rather than Roe v. Wade.
What is the broader impact beyond simply the ownership of minor league baseball teams and what MLB did in its restructuring? What is the impact of that exemption on the industry as a whole? Are there other areas that are impacted, whether it be minor league player salaries potentially? What is the power and value of this exemption to the 30 club ownership groups?
Well, in the first instance, it just puts them on the same footing as all the other professional sports leagues and teams as to which the antitrust laws apply. Why would baseball be any different? Number one. But number two, it could have broader impact on some of the issues that you mentioned on franchise movement. Any number of different issues could come up. You're probably familiar with the American Needle case and that went to the Supreme Court with regard to the NFL. And that had to do with, it had to do with the manufacture of hats. But right. So, yeah, there are lots of areas where it could possibly impact. You know, the other three and a half sports who have all operated under the antitrust laws for lo these many years, none of them are doing badly. So this is not going to hurt baseball.
No, Evan, it's ironic because when the shoe was on the other foot, and we quoted this in our complaint, when the Yankees wanted to independently license its intellectual property and the shoe was on the other foot, the Yankees complained in a lawsuit that they filed against baseball that baseball was an illegal horizontal cartel and that they were restricting output for licensing of IP. So there is a bit of a clear irony, like the position they took before and then what's going on here. I mean, when it suited them, they didn't like it either.
Some of the terminology in the complaint that jumped out at me, it's horizontal agreement or something to that effect, using horizontal. Can you explain that a little bit, what exactly that means and why that's a key phrase?
Yeah, well, under the antitrust laws, and what we call, you know, there's two phases to the antitrust laws. There's section one, which involves conspiracies among competitors. And there's a section two, which is monopolization. Put aside the section two for now. This is a section one case. And what that the horizontal simply means, that is an agreement among competitors who are competing at the same horizontal level, whether it be players, whether it be coaches, whether it be IP. whether it be for minor league franchises.
Is there anything else about the case you think people should understand? Is there anything I'm missing as for an overview of why you're going after this and why you think it might succeed now?
It is what we talked about a little bit already. Obviously, the elimination of the affiliations for these teams obviously hurts the plaintiffs that we've sued, but it's really about the communities as well. I mean, the reality is, you know, I went to Duke and the Durham Bulls was a big deal down in Durham. It was the one place where local communities get the chance to see professional players. You can see in our complaint how many players went through these minor league teams before they made the major leagues. I mean, I'm looking at our complaint, just picking out one example. I mean, the Salem Kaiser team had 112 players play for that minor league team and then go on to play in the major leagues. These were great teams. These were successful teams. And these were teams that provided huge revenues to the communities and jobs. And then just at the snap of the finger with basically no notice, Major League Baseball just decided, poof, you're all gone. It just doesn't seem right. It's just not right.
Right. At one level, it's no more complicated than that. What they did was wrong and they shouldn't get away with it.
Jim, you're no longer with Weil, I believe, but Weil, where David is currently in your own practice, Jim, you've had a lot of experience working with sports unions. Can you give a little overview of the different major points in time that you've pursued litigation with sports unions and just how intertwined you've been in the sports world?
It's hard for me to remember all the times we've sued various leagues. As you know, Evan, I've written a book.
I was going to say, read the book. It's a good plug.
On exactly that, which is available on Amazon. It's called Don't Be Afraid to Win, How Free Agency Changed Professional Sports. And most of the cases that we're involved in, I go back to the very first case, which was Oscar Robertson versus the National Basketball Association in the early 1970s. And that case and the later cases in football that I tried led to free agency in those sports. Of course, the analogous free agency occurred as a result of an arbitration decision in baseball. Interestingly enough, the free agency in both basketball and baseball occurred at virtually the same time, almost to the month, in February and March of 1976. And when that happened, professional sports opened up in a very positive way. You know, people have accused me of ruining sports because of free agency, but it's turned out, and when you look at it right now, it doesn't seem like anything got ruined. Free agency and the fact that players have the rights that they have today and the rules that have been set forth, even with the salary cap, which I still abhor. I was part of the first salary cap in basketball and then the salary cap in football as well. And with all of that, these rules have actually generated an enormous amount of fan interest and made these already rich owners even richer. So I don't regret a day of it, Evan.
Evan, having read Jim's book, it's not a law book. It really is for the sports fan. There's incredible stories of Jim's, 40 plus years involved in sports. Just great anecdotes, really funny. I mean, I knew a lot of the stories before, but there were a bunch that I hadn't heard about before. Just a great read. Worth checking out.
You both know and have worked with Bruce Meyer, who used to be at Weil and at the NHLPA, and now is obviously the Senior Director of Collective Bargaining and Legal for the MLBPA. What can you tell us about, both of you, about Bruce Meyer? And if you have any observations or thoughts on the lockout, I'd welcome those as well.
I'll start with Bruce and then David can, yeah. You know, both of us have known Bruce for many years. Bruce is brilliant. He's one of the smartest people I know. He's at the Jeffrey Kessler level of brilliance. And, you know, he's smart and fair. He has a great sense of humor, which, you know, may or may not come out in the context of negotiating with the baseball owners. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't think the baseball players could be in better hands. Bruce was with me in negotiating some of the major negotiations we had in the NFL over the course of 15 years. He and I tried the football free agency case in the early 90s, and he's steeped in the ins and outs of collective bargaining. And as I said, one of the smartest guys I know.
Yeah, Bruce is an incredible talent, incredible lawyer, really fair, knows this ins and outs. I mean, my only comment about the collective bargaining is I hope the players get what they want and it works out great. But as a Mets fan, I'm just hoping by April we're playing baseball. That's what I care about.
Got it. Thank you both so much. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, Evan.
You think Batman Returns counts as a Christmas movie? I watched that movie so much as a kid. It's very dark, the Tim Burton Batman movie. I can't help but wonder if it left some permanent mark in my brain that's left me tending toward the fun things in life like antitrust exemption and labor. But hey, Merry Christmas if you are celebrating. Thank you for listening. Remember, you can save 33% on an annual subscription to The Athletic by going to theathletic.com/baseball show. I will not see you next week. It's unclear whether we'll be bringing this segment of The Athletic Baseball Show back in 2022. But either way, I do promise you, you can find all of your lockout coverage at theathletic.com. And hopefully, I'll see you again soon.